Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at usaa.com/bundle. Restrictions apply.
Right now at Safeway, earn 4x rewards points when you shop for participating items with Safeway for you. Shop for items like Frigo crumbled blue cheese, Kellogg's club crackers, Coca-Cola, all liquid detergent, or Utz chips, and earn 4x rewards points with Safeway for you. Offer expires January 4th. Plus, get select holiday essentials like gift wraps, bags, holiday decor, lights, and more. Buy one, get one 50% off. Restrictions apply. Promotions may vary. Visit Safeway.com or head in store for full offer details.
They went with three people and a friend of them and Lee Bowery to London. They were just kids at 17. And they tried to leave Australia, all the stupid things, all the abuse. We have to leave it behind. This is our adventure. In the interview, Lee Bowery told me, well, of course, it's a lot of time and nobody would walk around in this costume. My ideas will never get a following. He had his glasses on with makeup on. And it was so nice because we are just human beings as well. So he didn't pose. He was just totally real in his outfit. I chose people who are very interesting, know about their history, can talk about the history, and wanted to be part of a book that really puts our admiration and our gratitude to what Lee Bowery did in his time without an internet stage, with just the market where we could buy some textile. That was it.
Welcome, Bamba Delva. First of all, congratulations on your book, The Legacy of Lee Bowery, King of Queer. What I like to do in these interviews is really find out a little bit about the person I'm interviewing from their childhood, because it sometimes, you know, gives a little bit of a light in terms of why they've come to this point in their life and why, in your case, why you've written this book. So when you were growing up, what cultural influences were actually on you at that time?
Well, I think, not a child from the 80s, but Lee Bowery and I didn't differ a lot from age, but I'm Dutch, yeah? So I come and still am from the Netherlands. So my cultural background was during that time when I was growing up, like the Face, Blitz, no internet. Some people can't imagine that, but no internet. So I lived in a very small village nearby the sea in the Netherlands. And I just had to cope with hoping that in the local magazine shop from the nearby town, I saw something. So it was very small, and of course the Netherlands is a small country, but as Dutch people, we think and we claim to be worldwide, globally thinking, but it's not, of course. We are just fishermen. So the time by then, it was just like, it was small. The punk era I liked very much, but then I was just a little bit too young. I was 13, 14. So I heard the punk era, like the Sex Pistols and Theater of Hate and all those groups with the small transistor radio. So that was it. But the image culture, the culture of pictures, videos, that was a little bit later. And that's when I really thought, oh, there's a whole wide world out there. So I think you can see about like this.
When I was 13 in 1972, I think it was, I saw Bowie on a TV program in Britain on Top of the Pops. And suddenly it was a realization about my own identity. I saw someone where I thought, oh God, I belong in this world, not in the world of my parents. Did that happen to you in some way? And in what way did that happen?
Well, when you live in England, like you did, but it was just like we always have to wait until it came to us. So there was no global television stations. We only had Dutch television. So it was always later. It was always, we were always behind. So Bowie was just like not in our world. But the copies were, so the glitter bands like Mutt and the Sweet and the Rugrats, who weren't like Bowie at all, but they were just copies of it, like commercial copies. We saw that, but we didn't see the original.
Yeah, I think what I'm trying to get at is because I lived in Britain, which I see, particularly in that era, as a much more repressed society than I imagine, you can correct me, than I imagine the Netherlands was during that era. For me, it was a trigger to my queerness, to understanding that I was gay. So I just wonder if there was a trigger for you and when that came.
Yeah, the trigger was what I liked, and this is why I wrote the book. I never liked the labels. I didn't could cope with that. So I always thought as a young child, early, so I, as a teenager, I always thought what I long to do, like being with a man or sexually feelings for a man, has nothing to do with my identity or my life. So I couldn't relate to the label of being gay. So that was out of it. But there was not another example. What I liked about Bowie, because I saw him, was that it was broader. It was more, it was a new label. It was just like an alien. It wasn't like a small label and you had to go with it. So this is what I want. And a lot of people think of the Netherlands as a free-minded, open-minded society. It's true, but only in comparison to other countries.
What sort of journalism were you initially interested in, and what was your reason to become a journalist?
I think storytelling. I like people. I always interviewed people who lead a very individual life, that people didn't understand what they were doing. I like people who try to be an experiment themselves, and not only in a sexual kind of way, but everything. It's just like I always admire people who try to look for their own freedom, that like their individual liberties, but at the same time, they can create liberty for us all. And I always like to be, as a journalist, I like to find out where they are.
So does this fit in with the idea of writing a book about Lee Bowery?
Yeah. Yeah, the book really comes from still my admiration for him, still my, when I tried to interview, I was in London and I was writing a book about gay and lesbian youth and when the Iron Curtain was still there. So I interviewed a lot of young people. And when I arrived on Gatwick, I saw the cover of the ID of Lee Bowery in his, like a pig. He was like a pig. And it was really, because I was with a group of people, 90% of the people I was with, gay people I was with, they hated it. They didn't like it at all. It was just like, how can we get acceptance when somebody is doing like this? And I loved that. I said, oh, this is the mechanism I like, because I liked it. But why did I like it and other people hated it? So when I was there 2 weeks interviewing, I tried to find him, because he was not known at the moment, at that moment. And he was just a London figure. He was just a London lover. He was not on the television. He wasn't internationally known. And I was just trying to get near to him because I thought, this is an interesting man. This is not only about dressing up. It's not like transvestism. It's not like drag. It's totally something else. And I didn't get it. And I wanted to ask him questions so I could get it.
So you interviewed him at his flat in East London in the high-rise apartment, which had an amazing special look to it. Can you describe it to me, or the surrounds of this interview?
It was very, because again, just coping it, there was no telephone. There was only the telephone cell. So I just, and I'm awful with finding my way. And then in London, it was horrible to find him. So I called him and I was really panicked because it didn't give me a professional look. Yeah? I lost my way to interview. It wasn't very, very good of me being a professional journalist. So he said, no worry, I will stand in my balcony and I will wave at you. And I thought it was just a joke. But then suddenly in some area, because it was just totally gray area, on a high balcony in one of the flats, there was this silver green figure waving. And I could see the sun on his sequins. And it was just like, oh yeah, that's why I'm there. So I went to the elevator and it was horrible. There was a man standing with a dog next to me and he didn't like me because I said, well, can you help me? Because I want to interview a person. He lives with, who are you searching for? And I said, okay, Lee Bowie. He didn't like it at all. No, it was just like, I would be very glad when I just enter the door of Lee Bowie. So the elevator came up, doors open, and there we was. It was just like, of course I saw the pictures, but it was totally different when he was like there. And he was so kind, so friendly, so polite. And I couldn't figure that out. How can a person be that outrageous, be so polite? And he was very happy I was there because he was just screaming all the time. Like, because, oh, now finally I'm getting through the world because you're the very first international journalist, so welcome. And then I had to sit on the couch and his flat, it was just like his own version of a club, I think. There were no furniture. It was horrible. It was cold. And he was just moving around. And my photographer just had a wonderful time because he posed. He was the best poser I ever met. And the interviewer was just, yeah, come and sit near me on the couch. And he just talked. And he was very happy with my questions because at that moment, only people saw him as just blubber, an outrageous figure. And now he could talk about the way he thought about art and fashion and human being and sexuality. And he was totally happy. He was just really happy that these international visitors came in until I asked him about his boyfriend, Trojan, and the interview. And he didn't want to talk about it. And you could see it as well because he had this point on his head. He had his glasses on with makeup on. And it was so nice because I was, oh yeah, we are just human beings as well. So he didn't pose. He was just totally real in his outfit.
I think one of the first times that I went to Commercial Road, where this flat was for an interview for Capital Radio. And I wanted to do an interview about a night out with Lee Bowery. And this was in the mid-80s. And I'd met him a lot of times before that. But what shocked me was because I knew him from club culture and I knew him to talk to in the clubs. You know, when I first met him, we ended up snogging and it was like sort of almost, you know, a half a romance. And I was so, you know, I was actually a little bit of a fan in a way, if I look back. And when I went round from the Capital Radio and did this feature, what shocked me was the difference between, as you say, his very quiet and intellectual persona on one side. And then this guy who goes out and the locals were throwing stones at him. He got such abuse. I mean, I was absolutely shocked at the abuse. And this was then, the prequel was the sort of intellectual side. Then came the abuse. And then we end up at the nightclub where the performer really came out. One thing that I always thought about Lee and that I discovered in his flat was his work ethic. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
He was, because in the book, we publish a little bit about pictures. Eh? So there is the, I always call it was the yellow yellow outfit with the marks on his head, the wet points. And during the interview and during the posing, thing broke. He didn't mind at all. He just says, oh, just wait a minute, I will glue it, and then it's finished, and then we go on. He didn't mind at all. It amazed me because he was so different than the fashionists I met, the designers I met, and I met a lot, and they were always into perfection. Lee wasn't into perfection. He was really good in the techniques. He was really thinking about things with the people around him, because he was not only... I never knew that he made his costumes together with other people. But he thought about looks. And what amazed me is that, as you said, he was such an intelligent person. He knew what he was talking about. 2 years before that, I went to the Documenta in Germany, and I tried to compare his looks during the interview with Oskar Schlemmer. And that was ages ago. And he knew him. And he didn't mind. And he was really thinking about, oh, yes, maybe you're right, something. And I tried to figure it out during the interview. Where do you get your ideas from? Because there was no comparison. There was no Instagram. There was nothing. He just thought it out. He was just thinking. And he tried. And I really, I saw him. It's just like, this is how you, it's really you. So there was no, as I said, everything was real. And then this image, this outlooks, and he was really thinking about techniques, about fabrics, about everything. And I liked that he always, during the interview, he liked to talk in symbolism. Like, as I told you about the sequins, he had all kinds of sequins. And I asked him, why do you like sequins? What is it? Because there are hundreds on him, on his helmet, everything. And he said, I like the reflection of the sun. I can be a light as well. And it's so smart.
But his costumes and his makeup often had a meaning. I mean, later in life with the spots and so on. I mean, that came later, and maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But I want to just ask you, first of all, because you touched on it, about these costumes came to life when he got in them. And I know that you say in the book that you saw the lifeless costumes at an exhibition in Vienna.
Yeah, I hated it. I went to, I think, Vienna. I just saw one, and I had contact with the person, the woman who made this exhibition, and there were his costumes without him in it. And I hated it. I was so shocked. And everyone, it was just, suddenly he turned into art, like fashionable, official art. And this museum, this art museum, put his costumes to the stand. But it was not about it. It was never about his costumes. He had to be in it. So I didn't like the life without it. It was just flat. It was just like, oh, there's a fabric with sequins on it. Well, and then the other one. Everything happened because he was literally in it.
I think it is about him being in it, because I remember going round his, and that was for an MTV feature, and I tried on, this was before he actually became like my sidekick on the chat show, but I went round his because MTV wanted to, you know, see what it was like on camera, and did a little feature about wearing one of his outfits. So he dresses me up in his outfit, and I am in no way Lee Bowery, you know? I didn't have it at all. What do you think it is about him that managed to transport these costumes in such a powerful way?
Well, that was a question for me as well. And I found it out because I discovered first my questions, where did you get your idea from? And when I tried to contact Bronwyn, his sister, it was such a very, like, an emotional talk. She really thanked me about writing this book. And she was willing to put a youth remembering from her and with Lee, and then put a picture in it. And she describes that he, as a child, as a young boy, really liked the wrestlers, the masked wrestlers. And thinking about it, because he got a lot of bullied in his Australia days as a young kid. And the mask, when you put a mask on, you really feel someone else. And there it came from. So I think he was just like putting life. I always felt like him also during the interview as well in the beginning. It's just like, you have a history. You know what you're talking about. It's not just like putting makeup on and clubbing, because he was so different than the other Blitz people. The Blitz people, the Blitz culture in the clubs were also about, look at me. He didn't mind at all, because he had a wonderful time. And when I talked to him, he just left his job at a fast food shop. And it was such different. How can somebody during the daytime work there and at night doing this? And then I spoke to Anne Holt, and she moved with him from Australia to London when they were 17. And the picture she provides in the book is just a very vulnerable, very like emotional young boy. This is not the Lee Bowery I met. Also from his stature, it's just like, he's not fat. We were talking about fatness. And what I liked about him, and this has really got to me as a young person, young human being, he had an answer to the bullies, because he explained, well, okay, of course I do this. I make it even bigger. Every bully, because I was bullied as a person, as a child as well, you tend to feel small. You try to get small and you try to get invisible. He didn't do that. He put himself on the platform. He put himself on the club, even on the streets, and dealt with the abuse. And even made it bigger. He didn't give in. I love that, the courage to do this.
Did Anne Holt talk about what you mentioned in the book as the incredible effect that Lee has had on how people think about art and fashion? She must have, because of being with him at such an early age and coming to London at the start, she must have witnessed or followed, let's say, Lee's transformation over those years. So what did she say about that?
Well, it was very strange, because in my Instagram account, I said there was this book coming. And then I got a message 3 days before the deadline of Anne Holt. And of course, I knew her name. And she says, can I join in? Can I write? And of course, this is just such a chance for me as a journalist. And what she says is, okay, they went with three people and a friend of them and Lee Bowery to London. They were just kids at 17. And they tried to leave Australia, all the stupid things, all the abuse. We have to leave it behind. This is our adventure. So they didn't have money at all. And then there was a fight, I remember, between Lee and this friend. And she says, well, it was very hard for me to get to stay in touch with Lee, because he was just like a rocket. And in the beginning, it's just, she also gave me a kind of a few drawings of his first drawings, and it looks just like a real designer. This was not the Lee Bowery who came out of this chaos. So what I think and what she describes is just as, that wasn't the whole of him. Nobody could stop him when he just went into this flat. They lived together. And then when he finds his way in the clubs, in the gay scene, in the Blitz scene, meeting Trojan, meeting Boy George, meeting all those people, and then he was out.
I mean, he met all those people. That was, you know, the early 80s.
Yeah.
And London was a very special place in the early 80s. And you mentioned the Blitz documentary, which really gives you an idea of where London was at that period. And this explosion that was taking place against a background of homophobia, racism, sexism, you name it. You know, the 80s was, apart from the music, I always say, pretty shit, you know. And London was, of course, the place where, in pockets, you could really be who you wanted to be. So how much did all of that play into the success in terms of allowing Lee Bowery to become Lee Bowery?
I think when I put all the pieces of the puzzle together, I think that he was just waiting for it. As a small child, waiting not to be recognized, but to do what he wanted to do. He wanted to be a wrestler, a master wrestler. Because his sisters, he loved this program. And I remembered as a kid, I didn't like it. I thought it was weird, all those men hurting each other, but he loved it. And he loved the playful, he loved the stage aspects of it, but he loved the costume. So I think that he just, as an Australian kid, he was just thinking about those fantasy. He knew about punk, he knew about the Blitz. He came into London and then he went, but it's not what I felt, because I was walking around in the 80s in London as well. He wasn't a success. People really didn't admire him at all, because he performed like, I think, really scared me what he did with blood and what Nicola being pregnant. He's just like, my God, what are you doing? Like safety pins in his cheeks. I didn't get all his ideas. But when he died, and years after that, people saw him as a big influence. So it turned. It wasn't in the beginning, but it turned. And the gay movement, as I met in the 80s, it was just trying to be accepted. Because that was Clause 28, it was very dangerous. And my interviews with a lot of young people, they really feared for the police, for getting thrown into the police, getting thrown out of the schools. And it was a really dangerous place. And of course, Thatcher ruled England. But what I liked about Lee, he didn't have that same reaction as the gay movement did. He didn't adjust himself. He just explored himself. But a lot of the gay movement didn't like it at all.
I know fitness is important, but I don't have time to keep up with all the fads and celebrity workouts that come and go. I need something backed by real science that will get real results and fits into my schedule. Caliber has been a lifesaver. It's a science-based fitness coaching program covering strength, nutrition, and healthy habits, completely customized to my needs and abilities. All I did was fill out their online assessment, and Caliber did the rest. The best part is, I'm not in it alone. Caliber paired me with an expert personal trainer who checks on my progress and keeps me motivated and on track. And I'm not the only one getting results. Caliber is top rated on Trustpilot with 4.9 out of 5 stars. On average, members achieve a 20% or better improvement in their body composition by week 12 of the program. Start a science-based fitness program you'll actually stick with. Get $100 off at CaliberStrong.com/podcast. That's CaliberStrong.com/podcast.
Trying to grab all the groceries in one trip? Oof, not how you would have done that. You know sometimes less is more. Like when you drive less and save with the USAA annual mileage discount. USAA, get a quote today.
He stood outside of all those things. And maybe I can sort of put that into context, because when I started with working for MTV, there was a big meeting before I was actually on air, before the channel went on air. And that meeting was, they found out that I'm gay, and the meeting was, can I be gay on MTV? Mm-hmm. And the conclusion was, as long as I didn't say I was gay on MTV. Now, this is the era of Clause 28. It was actually, it came up about a year after. So this was, you know, bubbling up, and Thatcher had already made very anti-gay statements in the press. And So it was a very difficult era for anybody to survive and have a job. Now, of course, yeah. I couldn't stop myself being open. So, you know, that was a little bit difficult in that way. But mm-hmm. there was a problem. And when Take the Blame started, people were shocked and intrigued. But after six episodes, when I was told, you have to make it less gay. And so what I did is I invited the Communards, Julian Clary and Nina Hagen, because I thought she was mm-hmm. a lesbian. I thought, okay, mm-hmm. I'm going to make it more gay, you know, just to be a child, yeah. I suppose, but just to make my point. And then the managing director screamed, get those faggots off the channel. And that was the end of Lee. And somehow I survived and MTV changed. And MTV was a modern TV station. I can't imagine what it must have been like to work in a bank, to work for, you know, like another TV station. And Lee stood outside of all that, and he didn't have to care. And I think, you know, you mention his performances and his performance art. I think a lot of what he could do was a reaction to the mainstream of society and a reaction to how people reacted to him.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right. I remember your program when you had these light bulbs next to you. And I always wondered, did he do it? And he was just like, oh, I did it with a battery here and this is like this. He was logical. And you're right, eh? He didn't have a contract with anyone. It's just himself. He was just exploiting everything. And it's very good to look back at the MTV era because there's a lot of changes. Most of the times we forget it, but when you see about queerness and gayness now in music, in art, it's huge. But what still I like, because the interviews with the people in the book are really is just like, I chose people who don't do drag. But Lee wasn't about drag. And it's just like those ideas really evolved.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I think you have to be very strong to be outside, as you described, to be outside and just take the piss. But he just had new ideas.
Now, the book is The Legacy. Why did you think it is important now, at this particular time, to really expose this legacy of Lee Bowery?
I had a talk with a guy called Lepustra. He works in Berlin. And I really wanted to interview him because it's kind of the reason why I did the book. And he describes the 30s in Berlin before the Second World War. And he describes in his interview that we don't have to be naive. Our rights can be taken out now. And it was, for me, very important that in the book, the legacy of Lee Bowery is, of course, about Lee himself, what he did and what he gave us. But at the same time, he was also a symbol of queerness. So is that, and in a time when there wasn't even the word queer. So he stepped out of the labels, and I like that. But at this moment, I really think it's important that we know our history. We have to know our queer history. So I chose people who can talk about this history. There's a woman, she talks about Martha P. Johnson, and she knows about the history. And Lee is history, but he's so important that we think, oh, like all the Instagram people, they put a filter on. And sometimes, not that sometimes, a lot of times, like, Lee, but you don't even know him. And I think it's too, he was too important that we just forget about him and just move on with a new filter on Instagram. And he had a message.
I think one thing you said there is really, really, really important, and that is that rights can be given and rights can be taken away. Yeah. And that's something that I think many of us forget, that the situation that we're in at the moment might seem comfortable, but as 30s Germany really showed, it can turn.
It is. And also what I like to, in the legacy thinking, is just like, it's not about looks. It's about the message. It's about the content. It's about the right to be who you are and to step out of the values as we are dictated in. So sexuality, identity, everything. This is queerness, that you have the right to be yourself. And it's also an answer to the Instagram culture from Look At Me and another follower, and Please Like Me.
How did you choose the artists that you wanted in the book? Was it on the basis of highlighting different aspects of Lee, or was it actually artists that you were fundamentally interested in?
No, it was just like the first question, because I approached hundreds of them. And the first question is just, I just look at their Instagram accounts and at their look, so the look they put on. And when I saw, oh, this is a little bit about Lee, but do they know Lee Bowery? Well, 90% don't even know about him. They don't know where they came from. So I picked the people that knew about him. So then it moved on. So then I had to choose, okay, you have to be willing as an Instagram artist to talk about your history. Because half of those people I really like to interview, they don't want that. They were just, some people were even mad at me that they had to refer to Lee Bowery as an inspiration, because I'm totally original. I think about it all the time. It's me, of course. We are standing on the shoulders of other people. So I chose, at the end, I chose people who are very interesting, know about their history, can talk about the history, and wanted to be part of a book that really puts our admiration and our gratitude to what Lee Bowery did in his time, without an internet stage, with just the market where we could buy some textile. That was it.
I found your questions really well thought out in terms of asking the people not only about their own art, but also asking about what they would talk to him about if he was alive today. Just want to go through a couple of people, so I'm going to look at my notes. Luis Peralta talked, what we talked about earlier, about Lee's craftsmanship, which was often overlooked. What did he say about it?
Well, Louis was a wonderful guy, still is, because his mother is really an influence. His mother is really a technical, perfect woman in fashion. So what I liked about Louis is that he said he was crafty, he was a craftsman. Some people don't see that, but I know what it takes to get into this kind of stuff. And he tried it himself, because in the book, there was a picture of him in a costume like Lee Bowery, and not because it was just a thrill for him, but he wanted to find out, how can you breathe in this costume? And I like that. And he saw his, the technical almost perfection of Lee, and the willing to experiment.
That's a really interesting point, because those costumes were very constrictive sometimes, amazingly constrictive. And as you said, you know, having to have a battery pack for the light bulbs, and quite often other sort of things tied around his body underneath in order for this to work. And during his, you know, performances, the one that the birth that you mentioned with Nicola Bowery, where she's inside his stomach, fake stomach as it was, with blood. So what did he discover about himself, Louis, when he was in that sort of constricted atmosphere of the costume? And what did you feel you discovered about Lee, maybe that you didn't know before?
Mm-hmm. Well, because in the interview, Lee Bowery told me, well, of course, it's a lot of time and nobody would walk around in this costume. My ideas will never get a following. They went with three people and a friend of them and Lee Bowery to London. They were just kids at 17. And they tried to leave Australia, all the stupid things, all the abuse, we have to leave it behind. This is our adventure. And this has changed. Eh? So I thought, how is it possible? Because Louis Peralta lives in New York. So how is it possible that this black guy, who does a lot about fashion, wants to make this costume of Lee Bowery from decades ago and wants to walk around in it? And Louis told me, he said, well, it takes a lot of time, craftsmanship, but still, how did Lee do it? Because Louis could only walk for 5 or 10 minutes in it. He couldn't breathe. So I liked it because, I said, oh yes, how was it possible that Lee Bowery went out in these costumes for hours and dancing and still breathing? Why didn't he faint? I don't know.
And then with Paola, I hope I get the name right, Idrontino, with her work being a mixture between nature and humanity, one thing that she describes is as the work bringing an extraordinary moment to an ordinary day. And if anything describes Lee when you see him, it is that extraordinary moment in an ordinary day, isn't it?
Yeah. And Paola, she's come from Italy. And when you look at what she's doing, it's not a little bit like Lee. Yeah? It's beautiful. I really think it's beautiful. There was no shock element in it like Lee did. But what she described is, yeah, it's like the sun coming out. And she admired this in him as a little girl. And she built her fashion, her craft womanship, on this idea. You can make a little bit of sunshine on a rainy day. So an extraordinary moment in an ordinary day. And she puts it so nice into words. And it's true.
One of the fascinating things about Lee, and I'm going to say his career, but his life in essence, yeah, was, of course, when Lucian Freud painted Lee and we got the man behind the mask. We got a naked person, something that, unless you were intimate with Lee, you were never, ever going to see. This was, you know, something completely different, the lowering of the mask. And in a way, it made him extremely vulnerable. And you talk about, or you have an interview with Luke Slyker, and they also talks about how they viewed that painting. Can you tell me what they said?
Yeah, Luke is a very young guy. So I was amazed that he knew Lee Bowery. So Luke bought during an illness, a disease, and what he liked about Lee is that he was just open about his boldness. And that was very funny because Luke really admires these paintings because it's just two extremes. Eh? The other extreme is he didn't recognize him because I saw Lee without any mask and I didn't recognize him because I only knew how he was masked. So this was the other side, the Lee Bowery as an artist, as we knew him. And the other side was just a naked model for Lucian Freud, but as open and without any shame as well. And really describes it. And it really, thinking about, there was once a man called Lee Bowery, and he was like an artist, and he felt no shame of being bald. This was just Luke his thinking. And I, of course, gave all the interviews to Brownwin, the sister of Lee, said, that's not true. He wasn't bald. He shaved his head because he couldn't, otherwise he couldn't wear those masks. And I loved it because it's just, I love those kind of things, that you have fantasy and hope, of course, and reality.
Lee used to come to the studio with Nicola after a night where I presume he was out all night clubbing, and he'd turn up at something like 8 in the morning because the show was recorded at 9, which was, you know, too early for everyone. And he would turn up with Nicola, who eventually became his wife, as in terms of being the guardian of his legacy. and of his costumes. He wanted someone who would really look after his work and trusted her. But Lee's sexuality was difficult to define because Nicola, I don't know if she does today, but she's always believed that Lee was really her partner, a sexual partner.
Mm-hmm.
And Lee was obviously queer. So what is this discrepancy in his identity? Did you ever uncover anything around this?
What I loved about Lee is that he said, I don't use my appearance to attract other people sexually. So that was very important for me, because I came in from a world, Dutch gay movement, that everybody, the man, tried to do this. Because this was the code, this was the norm, this was the message. When we would go out as gay men, you have to dress and you have to be there really for other men. So you have to try to attract them. So I really was amazed that really Lee talked about this. So it was a totally different view and message I knew before that. With me, he never talked about his sexuality, but I could see really that he missed Trojan, his boyfriend. So this, I think, because he stopped the interview, I don't want to talk about this. And he was totally different. And it was the only time, because I visited his performances. Sometimes he performed in Amsterdam. I went there. So it was just like, this was the love of his life. I don't know about his sexuality. I know from Anne and from Bronwyn and from, of course, the Book of Sutili, that he was also had his little heart. He was also a little hurted child in this. So I don't know. What I loved about Sutili, because I sent her the book, and there were a little bit years wrong, so I corrected that. And she said, no, don't think about it, no matter. Lee tried to confuse everybody. And I think that's true. He would love this kind of thing. We don't know. Maybe that's right. We don't know.
No, Lee would play games with everyone. He would talk about someone there, then talk about you here, and tell you little snippets of what he thought about people. What wasn't necessarily true. He would mix everything up.
A lot. Yeah, it's true.
So he was like a terror in that way. now, one thing I really appreciated in the book was the Australians that have been influenced by Lee that you've interviewed, such as Brendan De La Haye. Mm-hmm. And that really highlighted a different aspect for me about his background, and that the Australia that where he came from, and I have to quote it, was very unusual to live outside, I say, of the norm. Is that why? Is that the reason why Lee left? Yeah. I presume is that also the trigger, in a sense, for him to become so extreme and therefore such a great artist?
I think so. The people I spoke in from Australia, like Brandon, but also the Huxleys, those really amazing duo. And they talked about what Australia is all about, being normal. But at the same time, Lee is really honored by the Australian art culture. There's even a theater named after him. So it's just like, but you have to be like the Dutch painter Rembrandt always said, you have to die before they recognize you. Eh? So it's just like, I think he had to leave. And Holt also said is that they left from Australia to London to be themselves, not to be someone else, but to be themselves. They couldn't explore their ideas in the art colleges in Australia, in Melbourne. So they had to leave. And what Brandon says in the book is really that he admired Lee, because Lee was the symbol that you could even be outrageous when you're from Australia. And I don't know Australia at all, but I can imagine that. Huh? So for Brandon, it's like, oh, it's possible.
I mean, there are other people mentioned in the book, and you mentioned one earlier of Martha P. Johnson, but also Divine, Klaus Nomi, Keith Haring. And I remember actually seeing Divine in a North London club called Bolts or Lasers, a sort of very stereotypical gay club. On one side, men in lumberjack shirts, and on the other side, the Lee Bowery crowd. So it was always like a weird sort of mix of people. And, you know, like Boy George would be there, George Michael, Jimmy Somerville. I saw Divine there, and Lee was there. And I've never, ever seen in my life such an excited five-year-old. I mean, it was explosive. I mean, he was taking everything in that Divine did on stage. How important were these people that you mentioned, and I just mentioned them there, to Lee's development, artist or as a person?
Very important. It's very nice that you not compare, but you describe the reaction of Lee to Divine. I saw Divine, and I was just a small kid, and I danced with Divine on the stage. And later, I came to Divine because I thought that Divine would be a persona on stage, off stage. But it was just the same with Lee. Divine, being himself, was just a very kind guy, very friendly. But on stage, he was a monster, really a monster. He was totally unpredictable. And his songs were just like a machine gun on disco. It was just like a hot ball. But it was just the same. Eh? It was just the same that they had. And I can imagine why Lee really admired Divine. And those people like, because Jimmy Somerville wrote the foreword of my book when I interviewed gay young people. And these people, I think it's very important that we recognize them, that we just know where we are coming from, not only as a queer community, but everyone, because there were people, and still are, but there were people who died for us. Martha P. Johnson died for us. Lee did something outrageous. Divine did something outrageous against the proper taste of the world. And it was very difficult. What a lot of people see now is just like a YouTube clip or a song or just, no, these were people who were really fighting for themselves and for us. So it's it's very important that we recognize them, that we describe their world. And I think being at an older age in the gay movement, because I'm still in the gay movement, I can tell those stories.
One of the things I think Divine influenced was his performance in Minty with Useless Man, which was a hit in Holland, wasn't it?
Yes, and it's still a collector's item in Holland. So I don't sell it. But it was really true. And well, it was just, I remember it on the radio because I knew Lee Bowery, of course, and then he was in a rock band. And I don't like the song itself, but it's so funny. It's just like, what I can remember is that he wrote it as a parody of the Coca-Cola adverts. Something like this. So it's just like, how can this song become a hit in Holland? I don't know.
No, it was a parody.
There are a lot of remixes out of it. Eh? So it's just, I don't know. But
no, it's fantastic. Now, you've released a book and a flip book, as I understand.
Yeah.
Why did you want to do a flip book? And tell me what you were able to then put into this different version so people can enjoy.
Because I had a problem. Because the book is static. And Lee Bowery wasn't static at all. So when I did the research, I first collected all those videos. And videos like the interview with the Clove Show on the BBC, but also the video from the latest exhibition from him. I put it all together, but I couldn't do anything with it. So I really was training for months, because making a flipbook is very hard to do. But I would love it, because when you open the flipbook, Lee is talking to you. And I loved it because this was so important, and it took me a lot of time to get there. When you are on the third page of the book, suddenly Lee comes from his doorstep and he says, "Remember me, Lee Bowery." I love it. And this is what the book is all about.
Oh, brilliant. So where can people buy this book and they get the flipbook as well?
Yeah, it's on the title is just the website, The Legacy of Lee Bowery. And there will be, for the Benelux, it's the hardcover version because it's print on demand. I paid everything myself, printing on demand. But next week, there will be the paperback version, and that's global, from Australia to Turkey, from the UK to Italy. So that's really a black and white version of it. But the flipbook is nice because you can enter this flipbook anywhere you are. And it's colorful, and you can see all the pictures of the people. And there, I loved it because I found the interview with the father, Tom, of Lee Bowery, and his sister, Bronwyn, with the opening of the Bowery Theatre. It's such an amazing interview. And I couldn't do it in the book, of course.
Well, the book is amazing. I mean, it really is. And I thoroughly not only enjoyed it in the aspect that for me, it was part of my, I was going to say youth, but I was in my 20s. It's part of my, you know, years in Britain that I thoroughly enjoyed seeing Lee around and communicating with him and enjoying his art. And I really want to end, Bamba, on something that you've asked everyone else. But what would you talk to him about if he was alive today?
Never asked that question. For me, that's the nicest thing as a journalist. Huh? What would I say to him? I would love to ask his opinion about all the copies. So I would love to look with him at, like, not the copies, but the inspiration, the work Lady Gaga does, and Jean-Paul Gaultier, and Walter von Beieren Donk, and everyone. What did he think? Because in the book, he says, in the interview, my ideas would never get a following. But it was not true. And it's just like, oh, when you could write from the dead, and my God, people are still remembering me because I thought I was the only one. He designed a little bit for other people, but not those looks for himself. So I'm very curious about it. How would he think about all the people who are inspired by him in their work?
That's brilliant.
I don't think he would even understand this.
I mean, it's obviously a work of passion, a work that, you know, you have really spent years sort of developing in your mind. You can really tell that it's something very close to your heart. And it's a very special book. So, Bamba Delva, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.
At Sleep Outfitters Outlet, great sleep is a big deal. Save 40 to 60% every day on every Sealy, Stearns & Foster, and Tempur-Pedic. Queens as low as $249. Customer exchanges, closeouts, and floor samples. Inventory changes daily, so come in for your dream deal today. With no credit needed financing, expert advice, and up to 60% off retail, it's never been easier to get the sleep and savings you deserve. Go to sleepoutfittersoutlet.com for financing details and to find a store near you.